Welcome to the Crown and Anchor Greyhounds. This is Richmond Till We Die, a conversation about the Apple TV Plus show Ted Lasso, where we explore the characters, their relationships to each other, and how they're able to make us laugh until we can hardly breathe one moment and then feel with the deepest parts of our hearts the next.
I'm Christian, and I'm waving the wheat like nobody's business.
I'm Brett, and my brackets are already busted, but I am so excited to introduce our guest today, Eric Garcia. Eric Garcia is a Washington, D.C.-based journalist focused on politics and policy and is currently the senior Washington correspondent for a little outlet you may have heard of called The Independent. Yes, that The Independent. He also works as a columnist for MSNBC and makes regular appearances on radio and television. Previously, Eric has held positions at The Washington Post, The Hill, Roll Call, National Journal, and Market Watch.
Eric is also the author of a book titled We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. It was released back in August 2021. In the book, Eric weaves his own story together with that of other autistic individuals to discuss the social and policy gaps that exist in supporting those on the spectrum and to shed light on what it's like to be autistic in America.
In addition to his work in political reporting and writing, Eric is a huge fan of Ted Lasso and University of North Carolina basketball, which is how we connected with him on Twitter. So we invited him on the show to chat about college basketball and Ted Lasso, particularly the parallels between Ted's character and the real-life iconic men's college basketball coaches Dean Smith and Roy Williams. So, Greyhounds, please join us as we welcome Eric Garcia to the podcast. We're so glad you're here, Eric.
Hey, thank you very much.
So let's jump in first with the thing that brought us all together. Ted Lasso, you're a fan of the show.
Yeah.
Why did you decide to start watching Ted Lasso and what hooked you in and kept you there?
I think everybody started watching it during the pandemic. I mean, but like one of my really good friends said, just kept on tweeting about Ted Lasso. And then like, I think I was just like, I was looking for a show. I just finished writing my book and I had some free time. And I was just like, I need a show to watch. And then like, everybody told me, watch Ted Lasso. So I watched the first season in like 2021, like spring of 2021. And I just got hooked. I think it was just the writing. Was really great. It was funny. It was also very lighthearted. I mean, this was during the depths of the pandemic. I think people just wanted some comfort food television. I remember somebody saying that like food television really took off after 9/11. Like people really just want, whenever there's something terrible in the world, people just want something really comforting. And I think that was what Ted Lasso was for a lot of people.
Yeah, we started the pandemic with Tiger King and then we ended with Ted Lasso.
Yeah.
In addition to being done with your book and having more time because of that, one of the things that stopped early in the pandemic for a while were sporting events. And one of the first sporting events to get knocked off the calendar were the NCAA basketball conference tournaments and the NCAA basketball tournament. You're a big fan. And so we did want to bring you on to talk about that and some of the connections with the show a bit. So your expertise in fandom is with the University of North Carolina Tar Heels. Can you paint a picture for people who are not college basketball fans, what it's like to be a basketball fan of North Carolina in general, ACC basketball, the conference they're in, and then specifically Tobacco Road, that area of North Carolina that UNC is located in?
Yeah, I mean, so I should say, I was a transfer student to the University of North Carolina. I grew up in California, but I was born in Chicago. And the thing was that, so I was a baby when the Bulls were, you know, we're taking off. Like, actually, there's a photo of me. Like, my dad's business was doing like a charity golf tournament or something like that. And like, there's a picture of me with Michael Jordan, like when I was like 9 months. And and Charles Barkley actually hit on my mom that night in front of my dad. I feel like Chuck is one of the only people who can get away with doing that. But so there was that. But then I transferred to school because I went to community college first, and then I transferred to the University of North Carolina. And initially, I didn't put two and two together and realize that that was where Michael went to school. But like, I realized that afterward, and I was like, oh yeah, Tar Heels. And like, so like, I'm a Yankee, you know, born in Chicago. I went to college. I grew up in California. But you kind of get indoctrinated early on when it comes to North Carolina basketball. You learn, it's funny because weirdly enough, when I was in Chapel Hill, when I was a student, yeah, people are like, yeah, it's cool that Michael went here. But you hear more about Dean Smith, you hear more about Roy Williams and Bill Guthridge, and you hear very much about that kind of Carolina way. And you learn, of course, to hate Duke, and you learn that, like, nobody really cares about NC State. And you learn – and then, you know, that whole Tobacco Road, as my old professor likes to say, like to joke was, the Tobacco Road, because the tobacco crops were planted there for a long time, even though tobacco's not as big as it used to be. We get most of ours from other countries now. Those rivalries still exist. And it's very much the way that I've always seen it. People always say it is that, like, particularly in North Carolina, and I'm just speaking for North Carolina and Virginia here, because that's where the ACC for the longest time was before it expanded to like Florida. And now, like, you know, nowadays Notre Dame is part of the ACC, which I don't understand, but like, to me, the ACC, and particularly North Carolina, it's like the Tar Heels, that those are like the blue bloods of the universe of the state of North Carolina. These are the people who founded the state. Like, I remember I would meet people who, like, their families go back to the founding of the state when I was in school. And then, like, you had NC State, and those were working class kids. Those were farm kids. Those were kids who would grow up to be veterinarians or engineers or farmers in rural. And then you have Wake Forest University, which is, it was founded by, you know, missionaries, and it's very, very provincial. And then all out of nowhere, you have Duke, which is very much, I'm trying to be as objective about Duke as possible, but it's very much it aspired to be for a long time, an Ivy League school in the South. But then, even though I'd argue Vanderbilt is more of an Ivy League in the South than Duke is.
Pew, pew.
really, in a lot of ways, it was Coach K and it was Mike Krzyzewski. As much as I don't like to admit it, as much as I hate to give the devil his due, no pun intended, he really made it a school that you wanted to go to. So, and then, of course, up top, you got University of Virginia, which was the second public university founded in the country. UNC was, of course, the first, but it, depending on if you ask people from William and Mary, there's a dispute there. So very much, it is this very, at least how I viewed the ACC, is that it was very insular. And I was going to school when this was starting to change. Like, Maryland left the ACC when I was a student. It's this very insular kind of environment. It's like there's this region from like Maryland to Virginia to North Carolina to part of South Carolina that just like encompasses the ACC. To me, even though there are other schools like Florida State. So it's this very insular community. And so coming in as a Yankee, from somebody who didn't really focus a lot on college sports, it was just a fascinating culture. And like, I remember in 2016, again, you know, you talk about politics. I remember in 2016 when North Carolina banned, the bathroom bill ban.
Right.
If you remember, one of the things that happened was the NCAA pulled out of North Carolina. And I remember telling my friends, I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time. I was working in a newspaper. I said, Roy Cooper, the Democrat who was running for governor, has just won the election. I was like, because people cut class to watch basketball. You know, when I'm working nowadays, like, I'll have a monitor on to watch ACC basketball. It is very much a religion. And who you pick as your team, even if you don't go to that school, very much, I think, says something about you as a person.
I made the analogy for people who don't understand soccer in other countries that the closest analogs are SEC football and ACC basketball because of the identity that people take on. And in the ACC, especially when we talk about Tobacco Road, also the proximity, you have the academic triangle of schools. I was almost going to say teams, but it really is schools. You have UNC and you have Duke and you have, I think it's NC State. Yeah. And so none of them are more than 25 miles away from each other. And then you also have Wake Forest there in close proximity. And so, as you can imagine, not only the big feelings that arise, but then also the proximity makes things hot. What's it like to attend a North Carolina basketball game when they play one of their rivals?
Oh, I mean, it is. I mean, let me put it this way. I lived in Washington, D.C. I was an intern in Washington right after they announced the killing of Osama bin Laden. And like, you know, there were people all in front of the White House celebrating. For some reason, somebody brought a big U.S. flag, like, and people just started celebrating. And I've been in North Carolina when UNC beats Duke, and I've been in Chapel Hill. Hands down, it's a bigger frenzy in Chapel Hill. There's a street, there's this drag called Franklin Street. Like every college town has that drag. People light couches on fire, like jerseys on fire. You see people jumping out of trees. You see people blow, for some reason, somebody like you'll see people blowing vuvuzelas. you know, it's just this, it is absolute chaos and mayhem. And it's one of those things where it's this kind of collective frenzy. And it's funny because like I spent a lot of time also in my day job covering Trump rallies. And what I've told people and when I talk to students is I'm like, it's very similar. It's this herd mentality. It's this tribal mentality. And I think that it's something very different from even pro sports.
Yeah.
You know, in America, at least, because pro sports in America, it's tied very much to the owners and the whims and, you know, and it's where, you know, people change or they live wherever. But like, there is very much this identity, at least when I would go to watch Duke games, when I would watch UNC play Duke, it was very much this idea of North Carolina beats a lot of these kids from out of, and of course, I'm being a hypocrite because I didn't grow up in North Carolina, but it's like, a lot of kids from Duke come from Connecticut and New Jersey and New York. And all the other places like we all used, I used to joke all the time. It's like, if you didn't get into Harvard or Yale or Princeton, Duke was your safety school. So, you know, so it's like we beat all of those kids from New Jersey and kids from New York and all that. And like, this is our state. This is North Carolina. There is this very kind of regional state pride. And again, I'm being a hypocrite because I grew up in California, but like I did, it was through not just going to school at the University of North Carolina, but watching North Carolina basketball games that I felt a really deep affinity to the state of North Carolina. And it's why nowadays when I feel more at home, you know, from any, when I'm in any part of the state of North Carolina, whether I'm in Wilmington or Winston-Salem or Durham or Chapel Hill or anywhere, or, than I do oftentimes than when I'm in California.
You mentioned in your book how when you left Chapel Hill, when you graduated and were moving on kind of what the next phase of your life, that it really felt like for the first time you were leaving like a place that felt like home. I attended Wake for a short amount of time, and having lived in Winston, like there very much is that like affinity and that kind of Southern hospitality culture that really, yes, like even as someone who grew up in the South, but a different part of the South, Big 12 country, like it is like the culture there is just so strong when it comes to these college sports because they are so close together. And Wake actually used to be even closer to all those schools than it is now. It moved from actual Wake Forest, which is much closer to Durham and Raleigh. Tobacco money brought it further east. So, or further west.
I mean, tobacco money. And that's the other thing I think that's important to recognize. It's just like, if we could talk about economics a little bit, is that because North Carolina was a port state and because it didn't have a large cotton industry the way that even Virginia did, or even South Carolina or Georgia did, tobacco just became something. And then it, all those places are in close proximity just because of like where you could grow stuff.
Right.
So we've talked about some schools. We talked about only one player so far, which is Michael Jordan. We've talked about, however, you've mentioned a lot of coaches. And one of the reasons we wanted to have you on is because Roy Williams, who was an assistant coach and then later a head coach at North Carolina, was also a coach for a while at the University of Kansas when Jason Sudeikis was growing up and was a big fan. And people have seen a lot of similarities between Roy Williams and Ted Lasso. But first, I want to go back a step to Roy's mentor coach, which was Dean Smith. And there's a lot of talk about Coach John Wooden, famed UCLA coach, and Ted Lasso. Yeah. But I also see some Dean Smith characteristics and philosophies pop up from time to time. How would you describe maybe the character and the coaching and the success of Dean Smith?
So the way that like I, cause like, it's funny you mentioned that because it's like very much, again, we didn't talk about like you didn't hear much about Michael Jordan. And even when you talked about players, you would hear more about people like Phil Ford. You'd hear more about James Worthy as much as you would hear about Michael at North Carolina. But more than anything, Dean Smith is very much kind of the patron saint just because he was seen as this guy who quote unquote did it right. One of the things that was really well known is he never cursed. Correct me if I'm wrong. Like the only time you hear Ted Lasso curse is in the season one finale where he says, win the whole fucking thing.
Right.
Yeah. And it's and that's like, and then you're kind of like, oh wait, because there's a lot of cursing in Ted Lasso. Of course, you have Roy Kent, you have Kaylee, you have
Rebecca, right,
you know, but you have Rebecca, and then so when you hear, you know, Ted say, you know, win the whole fucking thing, you're like, oh, I haven't heard that from him.
It's a bit of a shock the first time you hear it, for sure.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's like hearing your minister curse. But also like there was always this feeling that again, like one of the things that was funny, I remember. Kenny the Jet Smith, you know, who of course is on Inside the NBA. He did a beautiful, beautiful eulogy. You should go back and watch it in 2015 after Dean Smith died, where he said, like, Dean never talked about winning. And that's very similar to Ted Lasso. He cared a lot about making these players men, making these boys men. I mean, there's that famous saying with Dean Smith that he was the only person who could keep Michael Jordan under 20 in a game. And that is very true because it was very much teamwork, working together. But then there was also the other aspect with Dean Smith, which was that he was an outspoken civil rights advocate. And you have to remember, being a white coach in the South, particularly at a university that was built by enslaved people, that was a very big deal. So there's a, you know, legendary story of he brought one of his players to sit down and eat with him at the Southern Pines restaurant in Chapel Hill. It basically led to the desegregation of the university. And that, I think, more than any kind of like winning, I think that's all that mindset has always kind of been in the zeitgeist, that not only is Dean Smith, you know, this legendary coach, but he's also this upstanding, upright guy. And on top of that, he's a civil rights advocate. And he was seen as a guy who, quote unquote, did things right, which is to say that almost all of his students went back and graduated or graduated or stayed 4 years. That kind of image is a little outdated because there was that report. Of course, there was an academic scandal at UNC. And it's found that the beginnings of that cheating scandal began under Dean Smith. And this was before the television contracts became a big part of the university's sponsorships and all of the things that we now associate with college sports. So it's a little fractured, but that image still exists. And this idea of like the Carolina way still exists, especially in Chapel Hill.
Yeah, the swearing part cracks me up. Dean Smith's players and the coaches that came after him under his tree tend to be like Dean Smith, quote unquote, disciples. And so the current coach, Hubert Davis, he's known as not swearing. Roy Smith was known as not swearing, except there was one time when Roy Smith in his last game coaching Kansas, Roy Williams, last game coaching Kansas, they lose the national championship by 3 points to Syracuse in 2003. And he's coming off the court and the reporter asks him about rumors that he might be the next coach at North Carolina. And he says in his kind of like Southern Kansas drawl, I don't give a shit about North Carolina right now. And it was just great. Yeah. CBS national television, a very Ted Lasso at the end of season one moment.
Yeah, it was because like, the whole thing of it was that in the background of that is in 2000, after Bill Guthridge had retired, Bill Guthridge, who was also one of the assistant coaches at UNC, Dean and Bill Guthridge had tried to bring Roy back. Because he'd been at Kansas. And the other thing about Roy, and we can get a little more into this. Roy took them to Final Four, took the Jayhawks to Final Fours. He took them to elite conferences, national, you know, regular season championships. But he could never get to the title. He could never get them to the promised land. And then basically there was that moment. It was after Syracuse, after the loss at Syracuse. And people just would have been asking because North Carolina had just devolved into a dumpster fire under Matt Doherty, who was part of that legendary team that with Michael Jordan and Sam Perkins, James Worthy and all them. And then they, like, basically the reporter's like, you know, everybody's asking about North Carolina. And he's like, look, and Roy being from, I think the other reason why he's so, Roy Williams was so beloved, at least in North Carolina, was because he's from Black Mountain, North Carolina, which is very rural. And as a result, you know, they're just feeling up, he's from here. He's one of us. But you know, he's just like, as a journalist, he's like, I understand you got to ask that question, but right now it's not very nice. And like, you can tell he's very frustrated. And then he just kind of just says, I could give a shit about North Carolina. I got 10 kids in there that I love. And it was, and then of course, he's kind of, you know, that was a very emotional moment. Then, of course, a few days later, Roy announces that he's going to North Carolina. And then, of course, in 2005, they win the championship, and Roy's first championship.
Do you see any other similarities between Roy Williams and Ted Lasso that stand out to you from the North Carolina perspective? We can see them here from the Kansas side, but like, what do you see from your end of the spectrum?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I see is that Roy very much, you know, he does care about his kids very much as people. Also, you know, a lot, one of the things that always frustrated fans like myself is that Roy Williams never called a timeout. And it was just endlessly frustrating. There were probably a few games where he threw, but then there were plenty more where he just let the players play. And that kind of, I guess you could say, that kind of confidence in your players, on one end, it's frustrating because you're just like, come on, you don't want to ruin the momentum, call a timeout. But on the other end, he trusted his players enough. During that time, he had people like Tyler Hansbrough and Danny Green and Sean May. And some of them went on to become assistant coaches for him, very much trusting in his players and trusting in their skills. I think that's a very Ted Lasso thing, in that you imbue your players and you imbue your team around you with the confidence and the belief that they could do things for themselves. I think again, that's something that you saw, you see Ted do throughout the season, is he kind of lets Nate the Great do things, you know, in the same way he very much, Roy very much, you could see he very much tried to set up Hubert for success. And I just want to, if I can defend Hubert right now, because I know he's getting under a lot of fire right now, and if I could kind of talk my shit right now, is that Hubert, yeah, I get that, like, he's still green, but like, A, people who are talking about him getting fired right now are talking out of their ass because he took them to the finals last year. B, I think the other thing is that the kids got under a lot of pressure. On top of that, this is still Roy's recruiting class. So, you know, these are kids that Roy recruited. These are not kids that he recruited. So there was always going to be a natural gap. And then on top of that, last year was such a fluke because it was just like toward the end, because I went to go watch a game in Philadelphia where Caleb Love kind of flipped on the switch and just like went hard. But all those. So I think that. So sorry, I just had to defend Hubert. And also, and I think it is important to have a black coach coaching black kids. But anyway, that's my tangent. But yeah, I think that there is some similarities. Respect for the players, respect for the process, recognizing that it's more about building a team and building a longer lasting operation. I think that Roy, very much like Dean Smith, was having trouble adapting to the new era of college basketball, where you have your one and dones, you have kids who just want to go straight to the NBA. And I agree, you know, I have a lot of criticisms of college sports. I think it's, in a lot of ways, it's a scam. But I think that Roy was still married to that old idea that Dean Smith taught him, like, you build a longer lasting operation, you build this cohesive unit, and that leads you to the promised land, that leads you to win. Not thinking about winning gets you to winning. And I think that's very, and then also, you know, just the Roy very much, obviously he would get frustrated at times, and, you know, he would kind of rip off his jacket, but also just kind of that sunny disposition and believing the best in people. So.
What is the perception overall of basketball fans in North Carolina of the University of Kansas basketball program, considering their shared history? And I understand at this point in history too, it might be a little bit raw because in the 2022 NCAA tournament, Kansas came back from a huge deficit to beat North Carolina by 3. But overall, what's the perception of University of Kansas basketball from a North Carolina perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think that so again, this goes back to the Roy Williams lore, is that like shortly after Roy Williams, his first time, you know, his first season back in North Carolina, after North Carolina was knocked out, if you remember, Roy went and showed up to a Kansas game with a Jayhawk on his sweater.
Yes.
And that was seen as like really bad form. Mm. That was seen like, dude, you're at North Carolina now. I think that in a way, and a lot of people wouldn't want to admit this, I think that there's a little bit of back and forth, because on one end, I think Kansas recognized, because on one end, because Dean Smith also, you know, has roots in Kansas, yeah, in the Fog Allen tradition. So I think Kansas lives rent-free in our head. I remember in 2017 when North Carolina had its championship run, when Kansas lost to Oregon, was it?
Yep. In Kansas City.
In Kansas City. I remember hoping to God that Oregon would beat Kansas, because I just did not want North Carolina to play Kansas, because I was so afraid. Because, like, I don't think North Carolina has beaten Kansas since Roy has come to North Carolina. So there's very much this feeling of, from an outsider's perspective, I think that there's always this feeling for Kansas that Roy loves Kansas more than he loves North Carolina, because he says he loves both.
Yeah.
You know, so, last year, the final was called the Roy Williams Invitational. And correct me if I'm wrong, in the 1990s, in the Final Four, Roy's first Final Four, because they were banned their first postseason.
Yep.
Because of that scandal. Roy actually beat Dean Smith, and Dean Smith was ejected. And it really kind of, and Roy was really kind of hurt. Like, even though he won and his team got to go to the finals, it really kind of weighed on him to see his mentor, this guy who was like his father, be ejected just like for this kind of conflagration.
I've always viewed the relationship between Kansas fans and North Carolina fans as kind of a quote unquote special relationship, like that between England, yes, and the United States, where I think,
yes,
and we've seen this in the last 20 years in World Cups, when the United States plays England and both fan bases kind of live rent free in the other's head. I know that when Roy, yes, left Kansas to go to North Carolina, there were a lot of fans that were like sad mad and probably lost perspective that North Carolina was the only school that Roy Williams would leave Kansas to go, yes, to. But at the same time, they just couldn't really contain their big feelings. And then it happened again, the inferiority complex, when Roy won those championships with North Carolina, and now everything's smoothed over. But I'm sure that we'll get another flare up in the future of basketball.
Right now, Kansas got knocked out by Arkansas.
Yep.
And then my Tar Heels didn't even make it to the tournament, just because it was kind of a disaster. But yeah, eventually, like, they are going to clash again. It's fate. It's Batman versus the Joker. It's not quite North Carolina Duke, because North Carolina Duke is shaped out of close proximity
and a lot more hate.
There is visceral hatred.
No love. Zero love.
I have friends who went to Duke, and I say to them, like, look, 363 days of the year, we're cool. 364 on leap years. But like, on those days, we hate each other and we will go at each other. Like, it's funny. I become friends with Ken Jeong on, the actor who went to Duke for undergrad and UNC for med. And like, we've kind of struck up a kind of fun relationship on Twitter. But like, we joke with each other. It's like, cause he was seen taking a selfie with himself at Cameron Indoor. And I tweeted at him when Carolina beat Duke, I was like, hey, having fun, you know? Whereas Kansas is kind of like, okay, we understand that's what bred Dean Smith to become Dean Smith. That's what Roy, of course, came up through there. There's this recognition that Kansas is where basketball kind of started. You know, we have respect for it. And it's like, it sucked that we lost. And like, I think it's more, if Duke is more fueled by hatred, I think Kansas, it's fueled by respect, but also terror.
Yeah. A little bit of fear.
Well, for his part, Jason Sudeikis has shown himself to be the consummate diplomat, because although he is a huge Kansas Jayhawks fan, I've noticed he's worn, I'm pretty sure it's the Carolina Blue Jordan 1s a couple of times in episodes, and he's always wearing Jordans. So he's very respectful, and even I would say reverent of aspects of Carolina basketball history.
Well, Roy helped recruit Michael. That's the other thing people forget. And there's, you know, anybody who's watched The Last Dance, Roy had some of the best lines in The Last Dance, like, you know, obviously he helped recruit it. He told Dean Smith about him. And there's that line where, you know, Michael Jordan says, I want to be the best player here. And then Roy says, well, you got to work harder than everybody. And then Michael says, I work just as hard as everybody else. He says, I thought you just said you want to be the greatest, you know? And then there's that line where Roy says, like, you know, Michael Jordan is the only guy I know who had a switch to turn off and he never friggin' turned it off. And like, you know, so yeah, like, I mean, you know, you can't talk about in this, you know, you can't talk about the legacy of Michael Jordan without talking about Roy Williams.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So switching gears just a bit, you mentioned earlier that you finished a book in 2021.
Yeah.
The title of the book is We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. You are an individual who lives with autism and who wrote the book essentially to shine a light on what it is actually like to be autistic, to be an autistic person.
Yeah.
So what was the process that led you to want to start writing this book?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm a political journalist by day.
Right.
So it started out as I was at a party in 2015.
Okay.
And a guy by the name of Tim Mak, who's now at NPR, great journalist. He's been reporting a lot in Ukraine. He offered me a drink and I said, I don't drink because I'm on the autism spectrum and a medicine can't mix with alcohol. Instead of him saying, oh, come on, have a drink. Like he said, oh, there's a lot of autistic people in DC. You should write about that. And at the time I was really new in my career. So I was like, yeah, when I get better at being a journalist. At the time I was covering, you know, economics and politics. And I was happy doing that.
Right.
Then what happened was I was working at a place called National Journal and the publications print edition was going to shut down. So my editor, a guy by the name of Richard Just, who's just a lovely human being, he said, I just want to have these kind of just bold pieces, you know, that run whatever. It's like, what are they going to do? Fire me at the end of the year? I pitched this idea about it, like what it's like to be autistic in DC, kind of like a fun little chatty kind of like piece about the like insider DC. That's what I thought it would be. And then he really kind of pushed me, which I feel what a good editor should do, to say, well, why should this exist? And I said, well, I think we focus too much on trying to cure autistic people and not enough on trying to help autistic people live more fulfilling lives. Mm-hmm. It's like, there's your piece, go. And at the time, again, this was 2015. So if you remember, Donald Trump at this time starts running for president. Yep. And it was the second Republican presidential debate where they asked Trump about vaccines and his belief about vaccines and autism. And what was interesting was that Trump, of course, says autism is an epidemic, you know, and he talks about the vaccines, and which kind of was a real prelude to how he would handle COVID. But the other thing that stood out to me was that arguably more was Ben Carson, who is a pediatric neurosurgeon, said, kind of gave Trump a pass.
Someone who should know better.
Yes. Yes. Someone who should know better. Someone who's very smart.
Right.
And that was the moment. Like, and then like, you know, again, I grew up in California and I thought, okay, Trump is, you know, an unorthodox Republican, but he's a Republican nonetheless. But I grew up in Southern California where there's a lot of, you know, Roy Kent's yoga moms,
right.
Who don't want to vaccinate their kids because they don't want to put toxins in their kids' bodies or something. But like, so like I thought, wait, a lot, you know, look, Trump is Trump. But like, there's a lot of people who believe that. And my feeling was, okay, I hear a lot of politicians talk about it because it wasn't just Donald Trump was talking about it. Barack Obama talked about it. John McCain talked about it. These are not people who are ill-informed. These are very smart people who are believing this. And my feeling is, as a political journalist, it was like, okay, if we have a lot of bad information about autism, that must mean we have really bad policies about autism. So that was really what kind of spurred the book. And really, so I read that piece for National Journal. And I think the next question is like, okay, how does that bad information translate into what it's like to be autistic in America? So as a result, what I did is I kind of hit the road. I traveled to West Virginia. I traveled to Michigan. I traveled to Tennessee. I traveled to the Bay Area, California. I traveled to a few other places. And I really just tried to get an understanding of what it's like to be autistic in America and how our misunderstandings of autism negatively affect autistic people. But also what a society could look like if we were more affirming of people who are autistic.
Right. Because one of the praises of your book is that it humanizes folks with autism and people who are on the spectrum in ways that where they feel seen in ways maybe they hadn't been seen before. And you're able to bring not only your own sort of personal perspective. It's not exactly a memoir, but you use a lot of your own personal experiences, but you weave that in so seamlessly with folks who are on the spectrum from kind of across the country who are in a bunch of different disciplines. Like you talk to professors, you talk to just folks who are, you know, working in sort of regular retail day jobs. You talk to all sorts of different folks who are in all sorts of different areas to try and show like, hey, this is not one size fits all, rejecting these stereotypes and kind of helping folks who aren't on the spectrum, who don't have an autism diagnosis to understand, okay, the onus is on folks like me to say like, what is the way that we're making, you know, that my sort of internalized ableism is keeping me from making this a better space for everyone to be more inclusive. And that's like one of the things the book does such a good job because you weave in those stories along with data and studies in such a beautiful way.
Yeah. I mean, really thank you for saying that. I think one of the things that I realized is that like, I think initially when the book came out, when I started writing the book, I think a lot of people wanted it to be a memoir, and don't get me wrong, it has parts of my own personal life in it. But I think that, you know, the impulse as a journalist is to always be, you know, it's like, I realized, you know, my story is only that, it's one story. And I think that the more I, you know, anytime I thought about doing a memoir, I realized, oh, there are other people who, I wonder if other people are experiencing this too. And then I was just kind of, and it was just like, anytime that I wanted to make it just about me, I realized, oh, there's probably something larger going on. Or I would just think to myself, yeah, but I'm only one person and who is this leaving out? And I think that was really one of the important things that I wanted to do is I wanted to include as many people as possible when writing about this.
Well, one of the things that you touch on in the very beginning of the book is that the conversation about autistic folks was led for so long by folks like their parents or their caretakers or other people who are well-meaning, but don't have that same experience. And so I love that you go to first person accounts of autistic folks and bring those in. So what are some of the, like maybe the most unexpected responses to the book that you've received and maybe the most fulfilling or kind of surprising?
I think the ones that are always fulfilling are the ones. It's funny, like a lot of times I get email or I get DMs from people who have just been newly diagnosed as autistic and they say their book helped them understand more. Or I get emails from parents or grandparents sometimes of autistic people. And they say, you know, it's, you know, your book made me realize like, hey, I need to, you know, put the focus on my kid and make sure that I think about what my kid or my grandkid wants, not what I want. And I think those are always the ones that like always mean something because it shows that you actually changed their mind and it made them rethink how they look out for their loved one's well-being. And then the other ones, you know, like I said, with newly diagnosed people or with people who realize they might be autistic, like when they realize that they're not failed versions of normal, and that they realize that there's this like larger community, that always is amazing. Because like, I'll say this, like when I was a kid growing up, like I was diagnosed when I was like eight or nine. And like the understanding of autism was changing as I was growing up.
Right.
You know that you're different. You may not know all the labels, but like, you know that you don't belong or you know that you're being ostracized by your kids on the schoolyard. It wasn't until I started writing about autism myself. It wasn't until I started meeting other autistic people, interviewing other autistic people, that I learned that it was possible for me to have a life, a fulfilling life on my own. Because like, I had heard all the horror stories about like, you're never going to be able to grow up or graduate college or live on your own or get married or any of those things. And I think that it was very liberating and very refreshing and reassuring to me through interviewing all these types of people that like, wow, I could actually have a good and fulfilling and happy life. So when I see that I get to relay, because like that was such a revelation for me when I was writing and reporting the book. So when other people, other autistic people particularly get that revelation, that is so reassuring. And it's something that like it's the best feeling in the world. It truly is.
One of the things that can make folks feel invisible or have a difficult time imagining their place in the world in our society kind of centers around depictions of different individuals or communities in the media. In your opinion, Are there any depictions of folks on the spectrum in popular media that you find particularly constructive or helpful? And if not, what might that look like?
So, you know, of course, there have been some really bad portrayals.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Ones like, I mean, there have been like the supercomputer geeks, the Big Bang Theory stuff. There's been some really terrible depictions. You know, I know people on one end, Rain Man was important because it was like the first time people saw autism. But then on the other end, it really reinforced some bad stereotypes about autism. So it was really kind of a mixed blessing in some ways. But I think that, you know, I've been watching on Netflix the show Extraordinary Attorney Wu, which I think is on Netflix. It's fantastic. There was that mini film that Pixar did called Loop, which was incredible. It was cast with a non-speaking autistic girl as the main character, Madison Bandy. So the girl who was playing this non-speaking autistic girl was actually a non-speaking autistic girl of color. It was one of the best depictions of autism I've ever seen. I think that it's getting better. I think the more that you get more autistic people in the writer's room and more autistic people, even just consulting on a show, I think has been helpful. You know, I think that I think what I was worried about when shows like Atypical came out and there was kind of a backlash because a lot of autistic people didn't like the portrayals. I think I was worried on one end that movie studios and television studios would just stop doing portrayals of autism.
Yeah.
You know, for a while that was the case, but I think now there's more of a, we could maybe do more if we do more, you know, stuff with autistic folks' input, then we'll get more people who want to watch it. You know, I think that's been where you're seeing it more. Of course, it's not where it needs to be, but it still is better. I think the fact that other movies that have positively depicted disability, not necessarily autism, but movies like Coda, did fantastically won an Academy Award last year. I think that gives Hollywood the incentive to make more, you know, disability minded movies. So it's still a long way to go. What I've noticed is that like a lot of times when autism depictions aren't explicit, they've actually been better than like when they're actually explicit. So like, I think, what was that one with Denzel Washington, Roman Israel, Esquire, whatever, where like, it's kind of implied he's autistic.
Right.
That's great. There was obviously Community with Abed, with Danny Pudi, who's also on Apple Plus, on Apple TV with
Mythic Quest. Yeah.
I thought that show is fantastic.
Yeah.
When it comes to depicting autism, but it still is getting. I think there's still a lot of skittishness, I think, about autism in a way you don't necessarily see with. Don't get me wrong, Hollywood still messes up deafness a lot, still messes up blindness a lot, but I think that there is still those disabilities still exist in the public imagination in a way that autism has just started to. And I think one of the things that I say to, and I say this to my friends in media who want to write about disability but are kind of afraid of it, is like, yes, you're going to initially mess up, but the only way to get to good depictions of autism in media, like in portrayals, is by constantly reporting, constantly telling stories, getting better at it and building trust. And the same way, the only way I think we're going to get good portrayals of autism is starting by doing kind of really rough portrayals of autism and learning how to do better and getting better and listening to autistic people and getting that feedback, you know, because like, I think even the fact that movie Sia did Music, which was so terrible and got such bad reviews, I think that in some ways that on one end, it was like, it was good to see people say, no, this is a bad portrayal. Like even Tina Fey and Amy Poehler made fun of it at the Golden Globes. But on the other, I think what it did is it showed Hollywood like, oh, if we do a really half-assed portrayal of autism, there's going to be some backlash.
Well, two things about what you said stick out to me. One is that like one of the core tenets of your book is how people with autism so often get pigeonholed into like tech, like STEAM, or sorry, into STEM disciplines. Like it's like, okay, like you can do the numbers, you can do the coding, this and that. And you say often in your book, like I'm living proof. Like I didn't want to do that stuff. I wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to be a reporter. And like, that's part of the thing is like with in media and Hollywood, wherever folks are making this media, like having those folks in the room and knowing that people with autism are capable of that. Like that in itself is a big piece of the conversation. And then two, I love that you pointed out the character and community, Abed, just because I feel like that was maybe even like a little bit ahead of the curve, and he portrayed it in a way to where I don't remember if it is explicit in the show. Maybe it is, but like it wasn't the focus. It wasn't the focus of his whole character. Like he was a whole character.
Yeah.
And that is something that's so important too.
Yeah, I think that like allowing autistic people to be their whole selves and not just having that one part. Yeah, obviously it's an indelible part of who they are,
right.
But like they can have lives, they can date, they can screw up, they can, you know, go to school, they can have jobs. Like, I think that that's incredibly important. I think having autistic people who are just, you know, kind of just living through life and who aren't hyper savants, I think is, you know, super important.
A depiction that we see in media, a group of people that are very represented in media, are those of reporters. We see those in tons of shows.
Yeah.
And to bring the conversation back to Ted Lasso just a bit, how did you feel about the portrayal and behavior of our friend Trent Crim from The Independent, especially his kind of departure from The Independent around the end of season two?
Oh, yeah. No, so it was funny. Like, this is a true story. Like, not this last Halloween, but the Halloween before. So like, I report on Capitol Hill a lot. Mitt Romney dressed up as Ted Lasso. And I cannot believe that like I missed the chance to say Eric Garcia, The Independent, to Mitt Romney when he was dressed as Ted Lasso. I missed that. I'm going to be kicking myself for the rest of my life with that. But so first off, I should say that like, British journalism is very different from American journalism. And I think that's been one of the things I've learned working for a British newspaper like The Independent, but just trying to, you know, see itself more as a global newspaper than just a British newspaper. But like, I mean, I think that it was definitely one of the things I joked about with my colleagues, that like when he basically outed his source, Nate, and also that he kind of didn't really ask Ted for comment. Like he kind of went around it when he asked Ted for comment about it, like in that one episode before he outs him. Like it was very much a breach of journalistic ethics. But Trent is a very fascinating character because I think that there is, you know, and like before I ever got into politics, I loved sports, sports punditry. I mean, it kind of does show how, you know, Trent and Roy, for the brief moment he's a pundit, do kind of show how sports media can sometimes contribute to the worst aspects of sports. And of course, Roy at some point says, screw this, you know. And of course, Trent feels very bad about what he did and he outs himself and he winds up getting kicked on his keister. I like the character of Trent Crim, so I'm interested to see what comes next for him.
So this pertains to both the show and your book. You mentioned in your book that you are a huge fan of rock and metal music and that you grew up wanting to be a guitarist and a musician. And you even quip in your book that you used to kind of have this debate with your dad about whether David Lee Roth or Sammy Hagar was the better Van Halen singer. And so I'm just curious where you guys, it's funny because that's the same thing. There's a little joke about that in season one of Ted Lasso. So I'm wondering where you fall in that debate.
When they play against Everton,
yes,
Coach Beard gets 51-50,
yes,
and then he's like the best Van Halen singer, and then Beard's like, ahem, and he's like, who's not David Lee Roth?
Post David Lee Roth era.
Likes Sammy Hagar, and don't get me wrong, I prefer Sammy Hagar. Don't get me wrong, I like a lot of Sammy Hagar stuff, and like Sammy's a better singer. Don't get me wrong, I think like musically, but I mean those first four or five Van Halen albums, you can't beat them. You can't beat them. I'm sorry. I think that David Lee Roth just fits that band properly. I mean, you can make all the arguments that, oh, well, Eddie writes most of the songs, but it's not David Lee Roth. It's not Van Halen if it doesn't have David Lee Roth.
Yeah. So I feel like I was like sheltered. Like my dad was still is a huge Van Halen fan. And like, I feel like I was sheltered from the Sammy Hagar like era. Like I didn't even know that was a thing until I was like in middle school. I was like, hey, this is a different guy. And he's like, yeah. I was like, okay. I was like, oh, I've just missed out on like half of Van Halen history, but it's okay. Like, I'll figure it out, Dad. Thanks.
So it was the opposite with my dad, but like, cause I saw the 2004 reunion with Sammy Hagar, which kind of went to hell. And then I won tickets in 2007.
Oh, nice.
To see Van Halen with David Lee Roth at the Staples Center, with my dad.
Nice. So, All right. Well, I want to wrap it up with one final question that ties into your work as a political journalist and reporter. There are some, very few, political jokes in Ted Lasso. So I'm just wondering if you had one that you found particularly cheeky or that was your favorite.
One of my favorite ones is when Ted asks Barry, he says, how's Mrs. Beard doing? Because he's talking like, I like moms because they're kind of like a blueprint of skin.
It's the episode where we meet Rebecca's mom and they're talking about mom.
Yes, exactly. That's a great episode, by the way. And then like he says, how's Mrs. Beard doing? And he says, full blown QAnon. And I think you hear Beard yelling, let's go. and you're like, okay. Yeah. Like as somebody who lived in Washington, D.C. during January 6th, I'm like, yeah, that tracks.
Well, man, Eric, thank you so much for coming on the show and chatting it up with us about Ted Lasso and your book. It's been a pleasure, man.
It's been so fun. Let's do this. Yeah.
And that is our show. We had a blast chatting Ted Lasso and college basketball with Eric. You can find links to his book, his website, his work, and all the other stuff we mentioned in this episode in the show notes.
We'll be back with more Ted Lasso goodness, but you can keep the conversation going with us on Twitter and Instagram in the meantime. Our handle on both platforms is @TedLassoPod.
This episode of Richmond Till We Die is brought to you by Gin and Kerosene Productions. It was produced by me, Brett.
And me, Christian.
If you're enjoying the podcast, please take 30 seconds to subscribe to our feed and give the show a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or a 5-star rating on Spotify. Heck, if you're feeling generous, you could even do both. As always, we appreciate all the ways y'all share your love and support for the pod.
Okay, I'm Christian signing off for Brett and Eric. Thanks for listening, and until next time, cheers, y'all.